Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Dr. Scott Bonar. Dr. Bonar is a professor of natural resources at the University of Arizona and leader of the USGS Arizona Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. He holds a bachelor's degree in science education from the University of Evansville and a PhD in fishery science from the University of Washington. He has conducted award-winning natural resources work in natural resource programs of state and federal government, universities, and private industry for over 25 years, authoring over 100 publications and supervising over 80 employees. Scott is currently serving as the president of the American Fisheries Society, where he has been an active and involved member prior to his leadership role. Welcome to the podcast, Scott.
Thanks, Nick. I really appreciate being here, and I appreciate your listeners taking some time out of their day to be with us.
I guess a bachelor's degree in science education is a little different background than from others in the field. Were you originally planning on being a educator more than fisheries folk, or was that just the...
I was, Nick. I actually started out in music. I was going to be a music major, and I used to play clarinet and jazz saxophone, and I was in that a while, and I realized, well, I'm not good enough to, make a living off this, so I'll keep this and hopefully as an avocation. And then I got into science education. My parents are both science educators. And I really enjoyed it. I got a chance to do a little bit of student teaching and then work with students and then also take all the classes for that. But I wanted to be more in something that was more outdoors. And so that's when I got into fisheries. I wanted to be outside a little bit.
You eventually went off and got your PhD in fishery science from the University of Washington. Being from Indiana, what drew you to Washington? Was it the program or was it just wanting to be away from home?
Well, when you go into graduate school, I was kind of looking around for programs that had offered different things. And so at that time, it was between the University of Wisconsin, University of Arizona, believe it or not, and the University of Washington. And so they offered me a good program to work with fish up there. The program at the University of Wisconsin, I was going to have to measure what the temperature layers were doing in lakes under the ice when it was too thin to walk on. That didn't sound like a very good graduate degree that I was interested in right then, as far as figuring out how to get out on that ice, measure what the temperature was doing. So I got a call from Washington a little bit later, and they said, well, come on out and try this out here. And so I went out to Washington, and I'm really happy I did. I really enjoyed getting my degree out there, met a lot of great people, and worked on various lake management issues. My study creature was actually a carp, a grass carp out there, the Asian carp. So they were using those for plant control. And so I studied how many grass carp you had to stock, what grass carp feeding habits were, all that kind of stuff. And of course, when I came back to Indiana and I told everybody I had a PhD in carp, one of my friends said, well, PhD in carp and a buck will get you a cup of coffee probably. And so I did a little bit better than that of, moving on. And I was very happy I got it. And I knew a lot about carp and lake management, but I'm probably one of the few people you'll run into that has a doctorate in carp.
So then after earning your PhD, you've worked for a few state agencies and universities and even the private industry. What are some of those stops that you made along the way?
I did a little bit of consulting here and there with grass carp when I was working for the university a little bit later. It was just some minor stuff. So I got my major job out of the university at the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I started there as a sport fish biologist. It was working with a lot of the inland warm water fisheries. So bass, walleye, some of the bluegill and perch populations. And so we'd go out and we'd meet with various bass clubs, and I remember being in the back room and people were talking and arguing about what regulations they should set on different lakes and what rules the tournaments should have. And it was a really interesting situation to see how all that worked. And then later on, I was promoted into the Inland Fish Research Unit. And that was to do work on all the warm water fish and the trout, the inland fish populations in the state, and was to conduct research. And so we had a wide variety of research we did, and I just loved being in that position. We had a team of great biologists that I worked with, and we would study things like, for instance, the impact of some of the lowland fish, warm water introduced species on salmon populations. We would study things like grass carp stocking rates. They had been using grass carp across the state of Washington for a few years. And so we studied to see how well those things were working. So we traveled all over the state there. We studied high mountain lake trout stocking. We studied things like catfish survival. So it was just a wide variety of different projects all across the state of Washington. So I really enjoyed it.
After working in Washington, where did you land next?
Well, I was tried for a position at the University of Washington, and we were in the running there for a spot with the university. And actually, my old roommate tried for that spot as well, for a professor job. And he did a lot of work on salmon and inland fish and had a lot of experiments on a wide variety of things. And I came in second up there. My experience was more on warm water species and things like that. So I came in second there. And then I got a call to come down and interview at the co-op in Arizona. And I thought, why would I want to go down to that hot, dusty place? You know, I didn't know anything about Arizona. I wasn't too familiar with it. But I came down here and I started looking around, and there was, fish populations from out in the desert where they would have a pupfish population that didn't have any fish around for, say, 50 miles. And it was like its own little universe in this little spring. And then they'd have a lot of these real neat rivers that were mid-elevation that had these wonderful fish populations of both native, and then there were some non-native fishes in different areas. They had some of the most southern trouts you'd find in North America up in the mountains, Gila trout, Apache trout. And then we were 6 hours from San Diego, 3 hours from the Sea of Cortez, and all the wonderful ocean fisheries down there. And so Arizona was a fisheries biologist heaven, and I realized it was a great, really a well-kept secret. So I got down here and I was thinking, well, I don't know if I'll stay long or not when I was interviewing, but then I got down here and just fell in love with the place. And so I've been happy since I've been here, and I really enjoy studying the desert fishes.
And all those stops along the way, you've been involved with AFS in various aspects. Did that begin in your graduate school experience, or is that something you picked up working for the agencies?
Yeah, that was something that I got involved with in 85. I went to the first meeting, I think it was 85, at Sun Valley up in Idaho. And they would take their labs, the professors would take their labs to AFS meetings. And that's something I try to do now. I try to make it so the students can go present at meetings and meet people at meetings, because it's so important. If you're a student or if you're faculty, to stay in touch, to be involved. And American Fisheries Society was critical throughout my years as being a fish biologist. I got to go there and I would meet people and I could say, hey, have you tried this in your area? You know, what sort of experience have you had with this sort of management technique? And just doing that and making a lot of friends along the way. Some of my friendships from even the early 80s or early 90s are still going strong, and those are from AFS. So I encourage everybody to do that.
You taking your students to AFS meetings is partially the reason for this podcast. I was in a workshop with one of your students, and he asked Patrick Cooney of the Fisheries Blog if they had thought about a podcast, and I thought, hey, I'd been wondering about a fisheries podcast too. And so a few hours later on the internet, I had a microphone coming my way via Amazon and a Twitter handle reserved, and I was doing a little background research, and here we are 75 episodes later. So, all because you brought a student to a meeting.
That's great. Getting involved in these new communication techniques, you know, podcasts, Instagram, Facebook, which isn't so new anymore, of course, and Twitter, and there's just so much out there that we can reach out now to various people. And I think it's great that you folks are putting this to use. It's really a really important thing to reach out and tell a lot of people about the wonders of fishery science and our fish populations across North America.
And all those connections you made in AFS and all the different roles you've served eventually earned you a nomination to become the president of the American Fisheries Society, a role you're currently sitting in. And every AFS president develops a plan of work that they hope to accomplish in the year of their reign. And yours has four objectives on it. And one of those points on yours is to work with other societies on issues such as climate change. So how will climate change affect fisheries and fisheries professionals?
I got involved in climate change. I was like so many other fisheries biologists. I thought, okay, it's there. It's kind of a little bit of background noise and stuff like that. And then when I got to the University of Arizona, I was able to really meet, that's a good thing about if there's a small fisheries program, you get to talk to scientists who are involved in other disciplines. And so a lot of these folks were climatologists, they had hydrologists, we had biologists, terrestrial biologists, and a variety of folks. And the more I hung out with those people and they showed me the data that was there, the more I go, oh my gosh, that, the climate change, this is a big thing. And it's not just like a couple of scientists finding out about this stuff. It's affecting people from all over in all of our fish populations. And so when I got into the presidency and we were doing our presidential plan, I thought, I've got an honor that folks would entrust me with the American Fishery Society as being president for a year of this. And I need to do something that's up to the American Fishery Society is the largest and oldest fishery society in the world, scientific society. So it was really important to me to do something that really mattered, that would make a difference and would have to be a big issue. And the more I thought of it, the more I looked into it, and the more things I saw, it was, climate change was the huge issue that we needed to keep tackling. And especially when you see the number of the slow rate that people are tackling it, and the number of folks who still, after thousands and thousands and thousands of studies, still deny that it is happening, I thought that this is an extremely important area to concentrate in.
So what are some examples of ways that it might affect our fish populations that we manage?
Well, there are lots of different ways. And what it really brought home to me was traveling around, it affects populations in different ways. Like, for instance, back in my old stomping ground in the Pacific Northwest, the shellfish fisheries, things like Dungeness crab, they are having hard times forming shells, oyster fisheries, because the water acidity is going up. Carbon dioxide, increased carbon dioxide in the air increases ocean acidity, and that affects the ability of all these organisms to form shells and affects the ability of reefs. And traveling around, I found other ways that affected some of these fishes. Like, for instance, down here in the desert Southwest, we are getting more and more intense droughts. Things are heating up. In the last decade, we've had the largest 10 fires in Arizona history. And I've had to pull students out of the way of these fires, evacuate them. Just this last couple of weeks, we have the Bighorn Fire that's up in the Catalina Mountains. And we worked with the Arizona Game and Fish and the U.S. Forest Service to help evacuate and hold a population of Gila chub, which is an endangered fish species that lives in one of the canyons up there, in the face of the Bighorn Fire. So these fires are coming through a lot. And then got a chance to go back to the Midwest. And in the Midwest, a lot of the fish populations The waters are warming, so when you got things like walleye and stuff, it makes it tough for walleye to be in a certain area because they're a cool water fish. And if the temperature goes up, well, you know, it's not going to be that good for holding walleye anymore. So those populations, you're starting in the southern end of the range, starting to be affected. The flooding back there is phenomenal. I talked to biologists when I was back at the Midwest meeting, and they said that the flooding has been stuff that they've never seen before. It's been in that area, some of the rainfall and things. When I went to Nova Scotia to the Canadian fisheries meetings, I talked to biologists who are working off the coast of Canada on the eastern coast, and they're seeing fish populations moving north. I think it was 22 kilometers a year? I'm trying to think what it was, but it was a sizable amount that these fish populations are moving north to get into the cooler water. And they say some of the fleets have to go farther to catch these fish, they're seeing river systems that don't have the fish that they used to have in them. And they're actually catching some tropical fish in their nets up in some places now in Canada. And so it was a real eye opener to me to hear about these vast fish migrations that are going on. And one of the biggest eye openers to me as far as how it's affecting fish populations, I went to Australia and had a chance to meet with the Australian Society for Fish Biology. And they had some of their speakers there talking about climate change and the effect on fish populations. And they were talking about how warm some of the southern seas are getting and how that is affecting a lot of their fish, you know, where they are at, similar to what's going on in Canada about fish movement into deeper waters and to more poleward. But I was able to talk to him about the Great Barrier Reef, and I talked to some of the coral biologists there, and I said, I heard, you know, when the coral gets warm, you have bleaching events, the coral bleaches, and it can survive these to a certain extent, but only for so long. And you have these widespread bleaching events, and then the coral dies after a while. And I said, I heard that you have lost 50% of your shallow water corals on the Great Barrier Reef. You know, I'd read that. And one of the coral biologists said to me, he kind of chuckled, and he said, nope. He goes, try more like 90%, mate. It's that bad. And, you know, we get back here, and I heard same thing from Australia, the president of the Australian Society for Fisheries Biology. She and her family had to get in a car and run from some of the great Australian wildfires that we heard about last year. So we're seeing this all over the place. It's affecting shellfish because of the water acidity, and that affects the fish populations. The fish are moving north. They've had predictions here in the western United States that up to 50% of the trout habitat will be lost by 2080 unless something's done. Because of heating and the trout populations not being able to live in some rivers. So you could go on and on. I'm just scratching the surface of what are some of the things that affect our fish and fisheries unless we can get a handle on these emissions.
Well, it certainly sounds like a lot of worst-case scenarios for some people, but there still might be some folks out there that think they just can't do anything about climate change or climate change affecting fisheries. So what would you have to say to change their mind?
I remember living through back in the 70s and things like litter along the side of the road and things like the Cuyahoga River, you know, in Ohio, catching fire 9 times. The pollution was that bad at that time. And people in the 70s said, you know, it's enough's enough. We don't want to live next to things like toxic waste dumps. We don't want to live next to places where raw sewage goes in rivers. And we don't want to live on roads where you can just take a bag of fast food wrappers and throw it out your car window. Things like that happen quite a bit. And so they put in laws. They enacted laws because people just got fed up with it. And it worked. You'll see, a lot of these things were changed. Things like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. So many important acts that were put into place just because the people didn't realize or just got fed up with how much pollution was going on. So it is possible to change that. It is possible to do stuff about it. And the thing is, people have to have the mindset it's real. People have done things about it in the past and it's worked. People can do things in the future as far as climate change goes.
And then there are still those that just don't believe in climate change and become quite defensive of their views. Another of your points in your plan of work is to encourage outreach and communication. So how would you communicate with folks like that and try to pull them to your side and find some middle ground?
Well, I think what people have to realize first is when we talk about folks like that, they're not all just one block. I teach a class on communications at the University of Arizona. And I was interested to see, I wanted to find what some of the most hardcore climate deniers, how they would react to the message. Because let's think about it a little bit. What they get or and what people get is a steady diet of various stuff from their media sources, right? So if you have people who are very good at marketing that fossil fuel is not a problem and that climate is not a problem, and you listen to that all day, well, you know, you're probably going to form that sort of opinion. And so I was interested in talking to these people and just show them, here's what the science says. And here, you know, I'm a scientist. I don't think I look like an ogre and everything. I think I look pretty much like them. And I'd just be interested in talking with them. And so I did that. I've talked to a lot of relatives and I've tried some different things and friends who don't believe in climate change. And what I've noticed is those people aren't one big block. Okay. You got some that are, you're never going to change them. They're really set in their ways. But when I went out to this one group, it was a citizens awareness forum and it was the hardest core climate change deniers that you might ever find. And I was surprised because I started giving my talk and half the room started heckling me, you know, about saying, oh, that's not true and all that kind of stuff. But the other half of the room, they said, hey, you guys be quiet. You shut up. Let's listen to this guy and see what he has to say. So I was surprised, even in that sort of environment, you have about half of them that wanted to hear it, listen to it, and form their some opinions and change some opinions. And then, of course, you have the ones that are incredibly diehard. They're hard to get across. So I would say to people, one of the greatest things, and you've had scientists from communications projects, Catherine Hayhoy, and some various scientists who study climate change communication. What they do is they say, well, you know, it's important to keep talking about it. Keep talking about it, because after a while, you do get people who change their minds. Some don't, but some do.
Yeah, it's kind of like the little kid always asking his dad for a puppy. Eventually, if the kid keeps asking, he's probably going to get a puppy eventually just to get the kid to be quiet.
Yeah. Well, maybe. One thing is about that puppy, you have to convince your dad that it's in his best interest. And climate change is handling that, it's in everybody's best interest to take care of this. Nick, I figured if I couldn't walk the walk, then I really couldn't talk the talk. I couldn't be out there talking about climate change unless I was doing something, right? So what our family did is we put solar all up on our roof, and it's enough to run the entire house. And we also have an electric car, and the solar, we just charge the electric car. And I got this and I thought to myself, my gosh, this is easy. You have an outlay for all of it at first, but I couldn't figure out why has our government, why has our society not embraced this technology? I mean, it's a neat technology. It's clean. I don't take my truck in for or my car in for oil changes. I just plug it in when I get home. I'm amazed by how maintenance free it is. And my power bill is $14 a month. So I figured if we can do it on a small scale like that, why not on a larger scale, on parking lots, on rooftops, what have you?
And another hostile bunch that you've had to deal with are some of the people in your own field, your fisheries colleagues. Many biologists have become quite attached to their sampling gear, especially if it catches the fish they're after fairly well. So I imagine you had quite a hard time years ago convincing many agencies to begin using a standard gear. How did the idea for a standard gear across the nation come about?
Yeah, the standard sampling methodology, we used to do that within states. When I was with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, I was asked to lead our team to design standard sampling methods for the state of Washington. And so we did that, and we had standard sampling methods for things like lake fish populations, you know, our warm water fish populations in lakes. We had standard methods for creel surveys. We had standard methods for bull trout surveys. Those are some of the things that, you know, I was involved with. And then when I got down here to Arizona, I started thinking about all the issues we had where, wow, wouldn't it have been nice to compare data, say, from Washington to Oregon, or say, across the West, or maybe even across North America. And I remembered there were books that we used to look at how fish populations grew, their condition, their catch per unit effort. And these books were Carlander series. You're probably familiar with them. The thing was a lot of the data in Carlander series you could compare, but there was even a lot more that was hard to compare from one state to another or from one political area to another. And so when I got down here to the University of Arizona, I started thinking, and would AFS be interested in something where you can compare data? And you look at other professions like medicine or geology, they have the same way to do geological maps. Weather maps, they're the same wherever you go. Think of the power there would be in communication and the power there would be to compare data. And so what we did to get that going is standard sampling is more of a communications issue than it is a science issue. Now don't get me wrong, the science has to be solid when you are using gear to collect fish. But there might be a couple of different types of gear or a few different types of gear. And those types of gear might catch fish equally well, but you just can't compare catches coming out of it. So we had to get everybody on the same page. And so what we did was we wanted people who are from a wide variety of different disciplines, from different areas, to design methods that were that people could use for standard sampling. So you'd get, we figure we didn't want just a bunch of university types, you know, coming up with some ways to catch fish, because it would have to be something that the folks in the state governments, like when I was with the Washington state government, would pick up. We didn't want everybody from the state designing them, because you had to have things that the university and the federal people did. So what we did is we had a wide variety of state governments, universities, federal government employees and consultants involved in developing these standard methods. And so we had about 100, let's see, there's about close to 300 different biologists from 107 different organizations, state, federal, consultant, universities, involved in our first go around with the standard sampling methods. And so we had those. We said nobody has to follow them if they don't want to, but here are the advantages. And so we had to have something that we could show to biologists. There are some real advantages in following standard methods, and they are in communication, they are in being able to compare your data across large areas and over time. And they are in, one of the things is, if you're using accepted standard methods and you have a court case or something that's fairly litigious, you can say, I use these standard methods, and that gains a lot of credibility. Where if you just say, hey, I use Fred's methods, they will ask you in court a lot about your methods and things. So it provides that sort of added benefit we didn't think about, you know, when we first got this thing going. So anyway, we've got the thing going. We published first in 2009. That was the first edition that came out. We're seeing more and more and more states that are taking on these standard methods. And now we have AFWA has asked us to do a new set of standard methods. And this will be a second edition, and it will be very much, since these standard methods, we don't want to change them. We want to change them as little as possible moving on. So we're adding a few new chapters covering water bodies that we didn't cover before. Maybe a couple new gear types we're kind of adding or tweaking. But by and large, things will stay pretty much as similar as possible so we can keep that standardization. So I'm proud to work with Kevin Pope from Nebraska and Norman Mercado Silva from Mexico on this new edition, and just a wide variety. We have about 100 authors going forward on this next edition. And, of course, the first edition, that was we had all those people, and that was co-author or co-edited by with Wayne Hubert and Dave Willis. And I was really happy and proud to work with those two folks. So that's kind of the story on the standards.
Well, it certainly seems like there's a lot of advantages to it. And I know biologists can be kind of stubborn with their gear, but why did it take 139 years of the American Fisheries Society being around to develop these standardized methods?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. Medicine, if you went in for a cholesterol test and somebody in Florida took your cholesterol by a blood test and somebody in Alaska took your cholesterol by, I don't know, a saliva, you know, a cheek swab, you'd wonder what the heck was going on. The people were doing different things in different areas. But within fisheries, it was done. You know, different things would be done in different areas. And I think a lot of that had to do with biology in the past may have been more at the local level. Like you may have been interested about the bluegill catch in your pond. And if you had a biologist who was your county biologist and he or she had a set of methods that would work in just a few ponds around the county, that may have just been just fine. What you were trying to do. But now we're seeing, the world's getting smaller with everything from the internet to large landscape issues to huge river basin issues. And now we're finding that we need ways that we can communicate and compare data over larger regions. And so I think that movement from fisheries being more of a local item to something that is more a regional, national, international, or world issue is responsible for a lot of this movement into standardization.
I know the standardization talks and talks about gear development and all that sort of thing are a big topic at the AFS meetings, and certainly the upcoming meeting, the AFS 150th, would have been the same. And the final objective of your presidential plan of work was to preside over the AFS 150th meeting. Are you a little bummed that this has been shifted to an online meeting and the celebration postponed till your past presidency?
Well, absolutely I'm bummed. And the reason I'm bummed is I don't get a chance to see a lot of the great friends that I enjoy seeing in person at these meetings. And so that is something that I'm pretty bummed about. But the flip side of that is I'm also really excited. Because I've seen people who are putting together a wonderful virtual meeting that's coming up. And this is something that's never been tried before on a national level. The Aaron Bunch and many in the Western Division, various chapters put on a group of local meetings here in the spring. And they did just a wonderful job. And that's guiding us for our virtual online meeting, but nobody's done a large virtual meeting this way. And so it's exciting working with Doug and his staff and a variety of the Ohio people who are still keeping up with some of the work on this virtual meeting, and then a wide variety of other people who are involved to try something that hasn't been tried before, and trying to see how it's going to work. Can it be used maybe in the future to supplement meetings? And so there's that excitement too. But the bum part about it is I really enjoy getting together in person and seeing a lot of the other fisheries biologists, you know, sitting down with them with a beer or what have you, or a meal, and being able to hear what's going on in different parts of the world or the nation.
And so this episode will go out on June 28th, so there'll still be a few days left to get your abstract submitted. How are the numbers looking? Are you aware of the numbers to know if it's going to be a fairly large online meeting?
Yeah, it sounds like it will be. When this goes out on the 28th, you got 2 days, I believe it is, till June 30th. And then after that, the abstract submittal is closed. So right now, I think there's about 600 abstracts that are, if I've heard right, in the last call that Joe Conroy, who's our who's the program chair, is keeping track of. And so we've got a lot going on. We're going to have a communications expert, one of the former vice president of CBS News, is going to be there, and she's going to talk about how to communicate with the media. How can fisheries people get their message across? And Carolyn Hall, she is an expert communicator with the Alan Alda Group. She's going to be with us too, talking. We have people talking on climate change. We're going to have folks from Europe talking about some of the main fisheries issues over there. And so how can we work with folks overseas, and what are they trying for fisheries techniques? So we'll hear a whole bunch of new things that are going on over there. Now, the thing with Europe is something that we wouldn't get a chance to do typically on a regular meeting because, you know, with all the travel and back and forth, here we can just patch into them. And so we can talk directly to their biologists over there. So we'll have that. We're going to have a day on diversity and inclusion. There'll be days talking about Latin American fisheries, and there'll be days devoted to Canada fisheries. And then also be we have the Consortium of Aquatic Science Societies, and so they're biologists from everything to plankton, to wetlands, to fisheries, to shellfish, you name it. And they're going to be talking about some of the greatest challenges that will be facing them and their societies in the future, and how we might be able to work together. So I am very psyched about what will be coming up, and we're going to be getting a lot of participation and a lot of interest in this, I think.
Well, early in your answer, you mentioned the Alan Alda School of Communication, and I listened to Alan Alda's podcast, Clear and Vivid, and at the end of that podcast, he asked each of his guests 7 quick questions to get 7 quick answers. And we do a similar thing at the end of our podcast where we ask our guests the final 5 questions. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Well, I've got a couple. I hope that's okay. Actually, 3. I like down here in the desert, there's a desert sucker and Sonora sucker. They're non-game fish. They hang out in the river systems. And we always think of the different fishes, the more charismatic fishes like the pipe minnows or the razorback sucker. I like these guys because they're inobtrusive. They're in a lot of our river systems. They're a beautiful fish, and they're important for a lot of the ecology down here in Arizona. And so those are native fish, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention carp. Common carp are introduced. They're non-native. But on the non-native side, I think they're an incredible animal. They're all over the world. They're kind of like the coyote down here. That there seems like anything that humans do won't mess up the fact that carp might be there. They're always there. They feed the world in some places, even like I remember in the Czech Republic, going over there and seeing statues and monuments to carp, and seeing a whole aquarium that was devoted to carp. So it to me is an amazing fish, even though it's a non-native and can be a pest in a lot of situations.
So we've highlighted your career here in this episode. So what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Oh, my favorite memory from my career. Let's see. Well, I've got a lot of favorite memories. I guess from my career, one of the funniest things that went on is we had a project where we were doing some marine biology, and we were doing this out at the submarine base at Bangor, and they had moved the nuclear subs over to they cleared some areas for a sub bay, and they restored salmon habitat in this other area. And so they did not trust us scuba diving around the nuclear subs, as you might imagine. And so they sent us out there, and they sent us out there with the EOD guys. These guys are the underwater frogmen. They put explosives on ships, and they take care of mines in the water and everything, about as tough as you can get. Imagine some of the Navy SEALs. And so they would go out with us, and then we'd go out. And we would be out with us, and they had to keep an eye on us. And they, we'd go underwater, and we'd collect a lot of these small leaves and invertebrates, and we'd bring them to the top after a dive, and they go, "What are you guys doing down there anyway?" And so it was one of the funniest things was trying to explain what we were doing, collecting all these little leaves and plankton and this little small fish to these guys whose business was blowing up ships and taking care of mines. It took us a little while to do that, but we were able to finally get that squared away with them. The other thing that one of my other favorite memories was growing up, and I think kids should get the chance to mess around in the water all they can. I know it led to my career path, but when I was a kid, I grew up down in southern Indiana, right next to the Ohio River and Kentucky, and we'd spend every waking moment we could in one of the big rivers and the cypress swamps, and then I had a lake in the back of our house. And so go out there and fish, go out there and snorkel. But one of the most fun things we used to do was go hunt for turtles. And we wouldn't hunt them with a gun. I mean, there wasn't any sport in that. We didn't want to hurt these little animals. They were nice animals. But we'd go out, we'd take a John boat, we'd scull. It's a way of rowing. It's very silent. And we'd scull out to where these turtles were all sitting on a log. And then when I was a kid, and then you get close to the log, a turtle would see you. And all of a sudden, they start jumping in the water. And that was a free-for-all. You'd catch those turtles, as many as you could. I'd take them back. We put them in a turtle pen overnight just to watch them and stuff. And then we let them all go the next day next to their log. Then the next day, we'd go out there and hunt the same turtles and catch them and bring them back. And so we could spend our summers doing this stuff. It sounds kind of boring. And I know the turtles, when we got out there, they go, "Oh, no, it's them again." But that was one of the things that really got me into biology, was just going out there and hanging out with all the turtles and fish.
Well, that certainly sounds like a fun time. One of your previous answers, you talked about how much you fell in love with being down in the University of Arizona. And so I think I know how you'll answer this next one. But what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm in my dream job. I love it. It's really a nice one. The only thing that I could possibly improve on this job is it would be fun to do sometime, maybe a little bit more in the future, a little bit more marine work just for a little bit of variety. And I do like to travel. I like to meet a lot of people from different cultures, different types of expertise, and so I enjoy that. So that's what I like about the AFS presidency, and frankly, the job down here as a professor, that I get to do some of that stuff, and so I really enjoyed it. But yeah, I'm in my dream location, and I've got my dream job.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Well, we're doing some stuff on climate change that is trying to get people involved in, working around the world. We've got a statement coming out on climate change. We're trying to get societies around the world working on this stuff. So if money was no object, I'd like to have a project where we're working on these large scale things with lots of different countries involved on trying to shift people's opinion to where sustainability and things like sustainability and working with the things like climate and pollution and overpopulation are things that we can make a meaningful impact on. And so if money was no object, those would be right up there at the top, because we've got to get a handle on them as a as human society if we're going to do well into the future. And I'm like anybody else. I want to be able to pass on a good future to the young folks who are out there, my kids, and, enjoy one now. And so I think we got to get a handle on this stuff. We're going to do it. So that's what I do.
And we've kind of highlighted your presidential plan of work, which included four objectives that must be pretty close to your heart. If there was one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I would say the importance of a good ecological education, and the importance to talk to young people about how important learning ecology and learning sustainability is. We talk about the basics in school, reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? Well, I think learning how to live with our planet is an incredible basic that I think would be a principle that everybody should know. I think every kid should know what carrying capacity is. How does carrying capacity work? How you can't just keep cramming more and more and more people into an area and have it be the same. I think an important principle is there's two parts. One is how many people there are out there, and then there is the use per each person. And getting the use per each person down is as important as it is for the number of people. Being able to understand how that works, how population and the use per person interact to affect our natural resources. I think those are fundamental concepts that kids should have, coming out of grade school, just like as fundamental as mathematics, as fundamental as writing skills, if we are to survive as a society later on. So those would be the things that I would pick.
Well, Scott, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your presidential plan of work and everything that you've done up to this point. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Well, thank you, Nick. I really appreciate the opportunity. And they can email me at scott_bonar@msn.com. That's scott_bonar@msn.com. And that's the best way to get a hold of me. And I enjoy talking with folks. And I think there's going to be a bright future. And a lot of the younger folks who are out there can really work to make it that way. And so I appreciate podcasts like yours and the chance to discuss our wonderful fisheries.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 75th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember the importance of ecology in education.